Hello, everyone. I'm Leslie Cornwell, certified nurse midwife with Midwifery Business Consultation, and I have Erin George on with me. She is an amazing midwife that is allowing me to interview her with all these wonderful midwives across the country. So thank you, Erin, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So Erin, just as a high level, I start out with everybody. Tell me about your midwifery journey.
Sure. Yeah. So I've been a midwife for almost 10 years. I went to the Yale midwifery program and have been practicing mostly in the Boston area, although I had the chance to do this amazing year-long fellowship with Partners in Health, working in Boston and in Haiti the first year that I graduated.
Oh, cool.
And that's actually how I, you know, got inspired to become a midwife. I was an intern for Partners in Health in college, you know, knowing that I wanted to do something in healthcare, but really not sure what, and really interested in women's health and reproductive health, but really feeling uncertain about medical school. And, you know, I had a chance to, you know, do a little bit of shadowing with some OBGYNs and did not love the OR.
Yeah.
Felt really uncertain about how I was going to, you know, gel women's health and reproductive health and a healthcare career. And my desk happened to be outside of a nurse midwife's office who was working for Partners in Health at the time. So, you know, literally by geographic location, we got to chatting, you know, as I would come in and get settled at my desk. And, you know, shortly after we started chatting, she knew that I was sort of, you know, interested in reproductive health in particular. And she was like, well, why aren't you thinking about becoming a midwife? And I was like, yeah, what about that? And
yeah,
you know,
why
I really,
not? It's like the light opened up and the, oh.
Well, it was just so funny. I mean, you know, I'm from Boston and I, you know, my family has always seen OBGYNs, and the women in my life had by and large had cesarean sections, you know, up until this point in my life. So I really, you know, this idea of birth and, you know, sort of thinking about how people meet their babies was very much informed by a hospital-based and highly interventive model. Yeah. Unlike many of the midwives that I eventually came to meet who, you know, saw a birth when they were like 6 years old or, you know, got to see puppies be born or, you know, like all these different amazing origin stories. And, you know, I didn't have that, you know, kind of thread. What I did have was being the eldest kid of four girls in my family and just really being interested in, you know, how our experiences as women were, you know, sort of shaping our own health trajectories and really just being very interested in, you know, some of the structural issues that we know can affect health as well. And then that all kind of intersected within this really amazing opportunity to be at Partners in Health and then to have this midwife be like, what are you doing? Why don't you just become a midwife? And that just got me into stalking all of the Boston area midwives and weaseling my way into, yeah, you know, births and becoming a doula. And, you know, that just sort of really opened the door for me.
Amazing. Yeah. When you were talking about the oldest kid, like I didn't grow up with midwives either. Everybody had inductions, doctors, and I found out about midwives just happened to be on the birthday channel. Now I'm like not a big fan of it, but it was what exposed me to it. But like, yeah, little subtle things. Like I remember very vividly, you'd go see your mom, you'd ask about birth and what it's like. And she just held negative and painful and awful, awful. And you get ingrained already from an early age of what your culture perceives birth as. And I'm like, but why? Like, why? Like, it obviously, like, you'd watch these documentaries in nature and third world countries, they would go deliver their baby and go back to work. But then why is our culture like 3 days and has to have all these interventions? So yeah, it was, yeah, I've got the oldest child syndrome too. So always, you always wanted to protect everybody and make sure everybody's okay and organized. But so you became a doula and then started practicing. Kind of tell me how, since you've gotten your nurse midwife degree, how practice has gone the last 10 years, like where you've been and what you've been doing.
Yeah. So, you know, I had spent different parts of my kind of pre-midwifery career working with Partners in Health. And, you know, when I was in nursing school, I actually had the chance to complete my final clinical rotation with a pediatric nurse in Haiti. So got to still be around babies, but not so much on the birth end, but on the postpartum end. And I had an opportunity to kind of continue in that in that pathway, you know, with the fellowship that I was doing, you know, thinking about more of the programmatic piece around global health and, you know, really helping people to access resources. You know, part of the work that I was doing was helping to write grants and, you know, getting things like IUDs and training resources to our partners in Haiti and supporting some of the midwives and nurses who are doing a lot of the, you know, the bulk of the labor and birth care where we were, you know, where we were based. But you know, I really wanted to become clinically competent myself and, you know, knew that if I kept obviously going a more programmatic route, it was not going to happen for me. So I started, you know, my clinical career almost a year after I graduated, working as a new grad in a really robust midwifery group at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And, you know, that's really where I've spent my career in the Boston area, serving, you know, people in, you know, very kind of like urban midwifery environments. And Brigham was just the most amazing place to be a new grad. It was a really high volume site and a super strong, you know, full scope midwifery practice. And I worked there for 3 years, but along the way had my first baby at a birth center in Cambridge, right outside of Boston. And, you know, that's eventually where I ended up practicing, you know, really wanting to also hone my skills in a birth center. So, you know, really started off in sort of like a higher risk, higher intervention model, but within this midwifery group that was really trying to hold space for normal within a very busy hospital setting, and then really switching gears and working in, you know, a community hospital setting that also had this freestanding birth center right across the street, literally throw a baseball between the two entrances. And it's just, you know, it's a really different skill set. I think most of us who go to a nurse midwifery program in the United States, you know, very rarely get to see out of hospital birth. You know, it often ends up being, you know, an elective experience, or, you know, you
have to work really hard to make it happen. You have to, with my clinical training, I was very blessed to do 6 months with the Amish Mennonites, but it was pushing really hard to create the contract, make it happen. It wasn't a typical clinical site for a nurse midwife, but it was something like when I signed up for the program, I was like, okay, it's a make or break. If you could tell me that I could do out of hospital clinical experience with your program, like that was, so they always picked on me because every step of the way I'm like, okay, you're sure I can get a clinical site? Because that was really important to me. I wanted the best of both worlds. I feel like how can we help with nurse midwives to bridge more clinical exposure to physiological birth? It is hard to practice in certain programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super hard. And, you know, certainly my experience working as a midwife in a birth center, you know, has really shaped kind of where I've ended up. And, you know, part of it was, you know, I always had an interest in research and had done a lot of, you know, kind of community-based research projects prior to going to nursing school. And, you know, as a midwife in a birth center, really thinking hard about the fact that, you know, we lack research on, you know, physiologic labor and birth. I mean, that's obviously, you know, I think we're really starting to make strides, especially in recent years, and thinking through, you know, what we know to be true anecdotally,
right, but actually the data collecting it all and having the funding to do the research.
And also, I mean, that so much of the funding is driven by high risk, higher intervention, which in some ways, yes, because there, you know, we all know in the United States, we are so off the mark in terms of, you know, morbidity and mortality when it comes to pregnancy and birth. And it's critical to be putting resources into those issues. But, you know, I think that often that happens at the sacrifice of how do we make sure that people who, you know, need and want low intervention, you know, birth and, you know, and could really benefit from, you know, low intervention care. How do we really make that happen? Right. And conversely, how do we deal with the fact that we often have, you know, pregnancies that may be high risk, but the actual labor and birth, you know, experience associated with those pregnancies doesn't have to be high risk.
Right. It's just one component. It doesn't take over everything. If she ends up with a C-section, how we still can do skin to skin. We can still do a lot of these components. We just don't all of a sudden label, well, one piece of her puzzle of her care and diagnosis became high risk. So now all the rest of her, I think we get that muddied water where she's high risk. She can't do that. I'm like, this part's high risk, but this part's actually low risk.
Yeah. So. And so I think we do have many, you know, hospitals and birth centers and also home birth practices that are, you know, complete exemplars of how you can be fluid in terms of where you apply risk. And, you know, I think that's where we need to really be driving more of our research and, you know, critical thinking about how do we really, you know, kind of move the needle on, you know, applying the right intervention and the right lens of risk, you know, when necessary versus, you know, there was a midwife actually that I worked with early on in my career. She was actually the midwife who, with whom I saw my very first birth. And she, you know, she talked about this. She was like, you know, if you have a hammer in your hand, everything looks like a nail. And I think in the US, I mean, we have such access to technology and resources and operating rooms and all of these, you know, incredibly amazing
technologies that are just so convenient to utilize.
Yeah. But when we apply that as broadly as we have, I mean, then I think we do see, you know, obviously the, you know, problems that are associated with that and, you know, really helping to create much more nuance in terms of how we're really addressing pregnancy and birth, making sure that, you know, our doctor colleagues have, you know, see birth in a way that isn't just, you know, people with an epidural flat on their backs with their legs up in the air, you know,
laboring down to the babies at the perineum and then push for a few times and then got to deliver the placenta and get everything done in 5 minutes. And then they're out. Like, it's just a totally different philosophy of like, just even just basic things, even with nurses, like this, the lost art of letting the woman, like these breathing patterns or what you, the step-by-step controlling every need because we're not giving any power back to the women. Yeah. It's some places are better than others, but the basics of physiological breathing, like she can bear down a little bit, she can bear down in between. There's no hard rule. We can't do these three and count to 10. And then then you stress out the kiddo. Like there's just these little things that really add up.
Well, and on that note too, I mean, I think that's also where, you know, even just how we bill and reimburse for birth. I mean, the nursing role gets so lost, especially, you know, within hospitals. And I have worked with some of the most brilliant, you know, people ever who are nurses who are just unbelievable with labor support and, you know, patient-centered care, you know, family-centered care. And, you know, I feel like their efforts so often go completely unrecognized. And they are the very nurses that should be, you know, in the leadership roles to then, you know, make sure make that everyone is kind of rising to their, you know, to their level of skill. And, you know,
they tend to be the ones that like to work night shift and stay out of everything because they don't want to be around administration. Like that's what tends to
Yeah. So I think that's also part of like where even within, you know, within nursing school and, you know, kind of, you know, training student nurses who are getting to rotate through, you know, their kind of like obstetrics rotation and being exposed to labor and birth, you know, number one, it would be great if it wasn't just hospitals, which it usually is. But number two, if, you know, when they are going into their rotations, are they going to places that are, you know, models of care that we want to see multiplied, or are they going to places that, you know, perhaps should be held up as, you know, there are a lot of areas of change.
Could you imagine if residency programs for physicians, you have to see 5 home births before you graduate? Like, could you imagine just that tiny little shift?
I mean, but I think it's true for midwives too. I know I still have never
seen home birth. That's true. Yeah. Midwives. I mean, it's not just a vaginal delivery you're seeing, but you have to see 5 at a home, 5 at a birth center, and you can do the other 25, 30 in the hospital. Like, that'd be amazing.
I mean, I feel like a huge proponent and supporter of you know home birth midwives and you know and just making sure that we are really creating much more you know partnership with home birth practices and making sure home birth midwives feel supported and empowered and you know connected to the system in a way that I feel like they often are. And I mean certainly not in Massachusetts.
Yeah, it's pretty standard across the country, unfortunately.
But I also feel, you know, I've never seen a home birth and it's just, you know, it's a wild thing. I can imagine, you know, that our many of the births that I've attended at birth centers are probably home birth like, but it's still not the same. It's a, you know, these are different, totally different options and, you know, reasons for you know, why people choose these options are so different. And
well, I think bridging the barrier, if we could have some sort of hybrid torqued act, that if you're going as observation, you're not doing any clinical, you're a shadow, you're a fly in the wall, your license isn't on the line. You're even if you're a nurse and there's all these gray zones, because a lot of programs are just, it's a liability risk. The insurance companies just won't allow it. So if we had some sort of legislature that you're purely there is continuing education, you're not the birth assistant, you're not part of the care, but you want to be around and at least experience the observant side, there's no strings attached of risk. Like, how can we make something so simple like that happen? It would help, like, even you, if you're like, okay, I've got a friend colleague out there, but I don't really want to go to a birth with her and just watch because I don't have malpractice for this. What if I get named in it? Even though you're a fly on the wall, you're the same level of liability, if not more, because of it. So how can we bridge some of these barriers that are just baby steps that can really make more access to opportunities and learning what other people are doing out there?
Yeah. I mean, this is where, you know, I'm still working clinically per diem, you know, as a midwife, but I'm full-time in a doctoral program, in a nursing PhD program at Boston College. And, you know, part of my hope in doing, you know, kind of pivoting to back into some more research work is really thinking about naming these issues, right? And, you know, and then helping to sort of, you know, build the, not only the data that we need, but also the representation that we need to, you know, to really create the drive for these things. You know, I think we, you know, there's some studies that have looked into, you know, how obstetricians and nurse midwives who are hospital-based perceive, you know, birth center and home birth. And, you know, by and large, people who have actually been exposed to birth in other settings have a much more positive outlook on, you know, what those settings
you fear
can
what
look
you don't
like
know. People, I mean, you yeah. fear what is unknown or you have a misperception. But yeah, like you were saying, instead of high level, these are the barriers, legislature, insurance reimbursement, access to midwifery education, business collaboration, like high level, like you need to dig down to tangible steps people can comprehend on a local level they can do. Mm-hmm. So if you could all of a sudden say, okay, we're going to do this little baby step and it's a very specific intervention or a very specific educational seminar that shifts mindsets, exposes them to, I mean, I remember as a new grad, I'd be so excited teaching. We rotated through at the hospital as the CNMs and OBs drills. And so here I am showing shoulder dystocia and what they do in the home setting. And they're giggling during the seminar. Here you are as a brand new grad trying to show alternative ways to manage a shoulder dystocia from your experience and your clinicals. You think you're going to bring something new. And it's just such a culture shift that they're like, oh, you did the duck waddle, huh? Quack, quack. Like you're trying to... So yeah. So those are those things, like you try to make a change, but where like as individuals, and like you said, doing some research, very specific interventions and things that are present.
But I also think, you know, thinking through, you know, representation in research and studies, you know, one thing that really got under my skin as COVID started was, you know, we knew this anecdotally speaking that there were plenty of people, you know, transferring to home birth practices, you know, at least in our area, particularly because the birth center where I work also shut down at the start of COVID. So I want to say at least half of my patients who I had at the birth center, you know, went to home birth practices in the area. And there were suddenly all of these, you know, people weighing in on the sort of like surge in home birth and the rise in home birth. And hardly any of the actual home birth midwives who are doing the work were being represented in these articles or in these studies. You know, people were, you know, who didn't have anything to do with home practice, you know, were
commenting
on this.
I think that's our society in America. We're like, well, that's what they should do over here, overseas. Like we want to put our outside influence, but we actually don't know the culture or ask for the experts that are on the other side of things.
Yeah. But I just feel like that's part of it. I mean, you know, where, like myself as a midwife, like where I feel like I can, you know, maybe make a difference in sort of the research and policy world. I mean, if we're talking about home birth, we need to talk to home birth midwives.
Like, you think it's common sense what you're saying. You do.
but I think, I mean, this happens all the time. We have, you know, OBs who speak for midwives all the time, you know, mm-hmm. just in general.
That hierarchy, unfortunately.
I mean, OBs who don't even work with midwives, or, you know, who maybe did some training with midwives, but work at hospitals where there are no midwives even in practice. I mean, this gets perpetuated and we don't stop to question, well, wait a minute, you know, where are you bringing in, you know, the authenticity here, or
the where are the biases versus the actual evidence, or where are the personal experiences coming in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, I mean, that's all part of, you know, maybe what I hope to, not maybe, I mean, it is what I hope to do. And then I guess we'll see what happens in terms of just thinking about, you know, whatever research work I do, or wherever I end up, you know, in my post, you know, PhD life, you know, thinking through representation and, you know, making sure that the work that, you know, we do as researchers, as thinking through policy, is thinking about how data is applied, is being driven by the people that we think we're helping or serving, and that they're also included in it.
Right. So. Yeah. Like patient-centered care, we should have patient-centered research. Like they're the ones actually collecting the data, their perceptions. We're not putting in what we think they perceived. And yeah. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I mean, so a big part of what I'm hoping to, you know, look at is this idea of decision-making regarding birth setting, and, you know, how do people decide where to give birth, but also how do we as providers actually create any sort of informed decision-making or not? And, you know, in the United States, everything is attached to dollars, of course. I mean, and I think it's really hard to imagine that the bulk of people, you know, start to have prenatal care and are engaging with providers who are like, is this practice the right fit for you? Is this hospital the right fit for you? Am I the right fit for you? And I think, you know, helping to think through ways that, you know, we can have some level of informed decision-making, objectivity, if you will, you know, regarding birth setting, birth choice, thinking, you know, people thinking about, okay, if I walk into a hospital with a 50% C-section rate, that actually may affect me,
yeah.
You know, if I have, you know, tons of medical complications going on and, you know, just a potentially really high risk birth scenario, like where is the best place for my care, you know, and there's just so many ways I think that we really need to improve how we support people in making informed decisions and then actually carry them out.
Well, I think two parts of what you're saying, having like a patient survey directly, like before you did the home birth, particularly if you started care in a medical system, if you ask the question to your healthcare provider, your physician or whatnot, what are your thoughts of a home birth? 99% of them are going to tell you it's not safe and it's dangerous. Like they're not going to, I've rarely ever heard true informed consent unless they had some exposure with home setting. They've done it before. They've had home births themselves, but they just, there's a very biased informed consent. And then people feel like, okay, I'm going to still pick this option, but now I'm less likely to follow up if I start becoming high risk. I mean, I've sent so many people in my home birth center practice to the triage, and then they're telling me after we did the right thing because of how much they were harassed and discriminated against, I'm not going back there unless I'm dying. And that's the last thing we want people to do.
Exactly. I mean, yeah.
We're not helping out bettering outcome by bullying people. And I mean, COVID is another example, not just birth. There's so many separations of evidence and personal biases and who's your science. And I mean, I had it as a patient the last month going into the ERs, you feel so discriminated because you chose an outlying pathway that everybody else is doing.
Yeah. So I worked with a home birth midwife to do a survey this past summer of the home birth midwives in Massachusetts and their experiences during the COVID pandemic. And one really interesting thing that people shared with us in the survey was that, you know, their experience of transfer during COVID at times actually got better. And several of the midwives commented that they felt like because of all of the really restrictive practices that were happening that in the hospital. Yeah. And the strain on our systems, which we know have happened, you know, when it comes to pregnancy and birth in particular, that, you know, people on the other end of the phone or the other end of the transfer were much more supportive of why people had chosen home birth in the first place. Mm-hmm. And also were much more conscientious about closing the loop, you know, with the home birth midwife. So several of the midwives we surveyed talked about that, but they really felt like, you know, sometimes in their whole careers, for the first time ever, they were having, you know, much more positive experiences with transfer. And I, you know, of course reading it, I'm like, yes, like this is what we need to like.
It only took a pandemic to change. Yeah. Right. Midwifery in the US. That's what I joke about all the time. It only takes a pandemic for people to realize the hospital is a sick house. That's all it took.
I know, but I mean, you know, that I think if we, you know, that's the part that we need to sort of, again, if you're asking the questions, right? Like if, you know, how are these transfers going? What, when they're happening well, how can we replicate that?
Exactly. So that people, create models with the Home Birth Summit and these other wonderful organizations.
Right. So that, you know, no one feels stigmatized, no one feels put upon, you know, I think that happens so much on the hospital side where people are like, oh, great. Like we have this sort of car wreck that we have to deal with.
Yep. The train wreck's coming.
And instead it's like, no, actually this is a really appropriate transfer. This makes sense. Here we are having an opportunity to provide, you know, care that this person needs and actually meeting their, you know, changing kind of health status in their labor in a way that we know how to do because we have the skills to do it and the resources to do it in this hospital setting. I mean, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. baby steps. I just did an interview with Lorraine Garcia on Saturday. Her interview will come out next week. Have you spoke with her or connected with her? She has a PhD in research as well. She's in Las Vegas, Nevada. She's year three of her PhD. Her passion is obstetrical violence and how can we help bridge some of these subconscious cultural replicating things that are happening. I think you two would get along famously. I'm like, I got to keep noting all my researchers. We could have like a NBC research cohort or something.
Yeah, I that's awesome. And I would love to connect with her. And I mean, I think on a side note, I mean, I'm a very late convert to, you know, to Twitter. I've really been off of social media for the better part of the last 15 years, I would say, but my PhD advisor, you know, had a heart to heart with me in the fall. And she was like, you need to get on Twitter. There's like a lot of great academic things going on. It's a great way to connect with, you know, different midwives who are doing all kinds of things.
It's all how you utilize it. Yeah.
She was so right. But I'd have to actually look, but I think I have more like midwife connections in the UK, Australia, and New Zealand than I do across the United States.
Very interesting.
Which is partly because I think, as I don't know, at least in my circle, very few of my midwife colleagues are on Twitter. But also I think, you know, it speaks to the fact that in the US, I mean, obviously there aren't tons of midwives and there aren't tons of midwives who are,
you know, you've got a niche on
top
of
there
and
sort of teaching and research and, you know, all the things. So anyway. It's always so wonderful to hear other midwife names and, you know.
Yeah. Well, because they see the challenges and they're like, I'm one person, I can catch wonderful babies, I can support and educate. But if I want to improve things on a bigger scale, you have to step back and look at the system. What is something based on your passion and your unique skills? Can you cause a ripple effect to really support the midwives and the backdrops? Like, I think that's where a lot of people are like, well, I like being a midwife, but I see this challenge, I see this struggle. And instead of saying, well, I'm just going to keep being a midwife and it's going to keep happening, very few step back and say, well, how do I fix this problem? How do I fix, is it a policy? Is it I mean, there's an amazing midwife, Maylene Hegenberger in Europe that I'm waiting for FDA. We've been waiting for a year now. She has this amazing speculum to help with suturing and she invented it. It took her 4 years. She just kept seeing this problem. So I think it takes midwives to not just think about great ideas, but how do we apply them? How do we make change by actively doing those day-to-day things we're passionate about?
Yeah. And I think that's also, you know, what I hope to see, you know, happen in these next, you know, hopefully years that I have in practice. But I mean, you know, that we really think through, you know, roles that allow us to, you know, you know, stay clinical if we want to stay clinical, but then also have, you know, other pathways for teaching and research and, you know, policy and advocacy. And, you know, in the Boston area, we had a midwifery program for a long time at Boston University that, you know, has been closed for, I think, over 2 decades now. And even though we have tons of midwives in this area, we do not have a midwifery training program within the Metro Boston region. And we do have a small hospital-based program in the western part of our state. But, you know, the midwives in the Boston area who number in, you know, probably, I mean, definitely the hundreds, I feel like mm-hmm. we look at all the practices, you know, we don't have a midwifery, you know, academic home, whether that's a hospital-based program or, you know, a school-based program. And I think, you know, that is to our detriment, you know, as a community. And I think, you know, as we try to think about, you know, state level action for different things, you know, it would, I think other states that have, you know, a powerful, you know, midwifery programs, and, you know, really well organized, you know,
create a satellite replication versus reworking the wheel, getting them to say, okay, this is a prime location to have a satellite hub. I know nursing schools do it all the time. I have a degree for a place I never went to the campus. They would leverage the other side of the state to bridge the gap and utilize. So why can't we do that with midwifery schools? Why can't we have satellite campuses and expand instead of making brand new midwifery programs? Why can't we create a satellite franchise with, but that's my coming out. I don't know the reasoning.
Yeah. So. No, I mean, and I don't know. I mean, I don't think any of us do when we talk about it.
Yeah, there'll be some midwifery directors listening to this rolling their eyes. They don't know how
they don't know. But, you know, I really hope that changes, you know, in this area, because I think, you know, part of what makes a difference in other places is that there are more pathways and more roles to fill, you know, not that obviously doing the clinical work is critical and, you know, paramount in many ways, but for, you know, for people who need or want to take a step back or want to become, you know, like clinical scholars or, you know, or really, you know, help to, you know, do some of the academic teaching required to, you know, become a nurse midwife or, you know, partner with home birth groups and, you know, home birth training and, you know, have more of a, you know, kind of like multi-site
bridging the gap. Model of care. you could be the liaison between the kind of like the drug reps, you're like the pharmaceutical and the training and going on site. But yeah, how can we create more of a cohesive transition to speak both languages?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for, I mean, you know, for midwife students to learn from each other. I mean, like for people who are in a home birth training model and for, you know, nurse midwives and, you know, for that kind of collaboration to
reversal,
be
happening.
Yeah, for home birth midwives to be teaching, you know, nurse, you know, like it just, there's so much of that kind of cross collaboration and, you know, support for midwives in all settings that need to happen, you know, not only across our country, but really across the world. And I think, you know,
there's a lot, hopes, I know, and that's the big thing Lorraine and I talk about. It's like, if you try to think of everything, you're so overwhelming. And what she reinforces, like, think of your local community, getting involved in changes, not just doing your practice and doing your job and coming and going, but what are little things on a local level? And then it's a ripple effect. It's a compounding where more and more people are doing it and you're going to have a massive momentum, but we have to break these things down tiny. Cause if you think of every single thing and how complex it is, you get overwhelmed and you shut down. I mean, that was very clear with COVID and just lifestyle the last 2 years. Yes. You have to simplify, you have to just get to these baby steps and root causes. And that's why I'm passionate about the business side and the professional development, because whether you're working in the hospital or you're working in the home setting, you're running your own practice, like you need to negotiate, you need to understand business finances, you want to add a new service to a practice, you want to negotiate your value of a higher salary and your skill set, like every direction, it's important to have these skill sets that just aren't taught in midwifery school.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, part of where some of that cross collaboration can happen. We have, you know, nurse midwives who are doing, you know, home birth in Massachusetts, and, you know, how amazing would it be for nurse midwifery students to be like learning from them about how they finance that and make that work. And how is that the same or different compared to, you know, midwives who don't have a CNM license, and, mm-hmm. you know, where are some of those kind of areas to improve and, right. you know, kind of make sure that we're getting fair reimbursement and all the things. I mean, it's you know.
It's a lot. But yeah, anytime something is new, as you know, like it's scary. And I talked to so many nurse midwives. I like the idea, but then they have these myths and misperceptions of not just home births, but running a midwifery private practice. Whether they'll say, well, I don't want to be on call 24/7. I was like, okay, start a clinic, start a niche service. Like you don't have to be on call 24/7. So I think you and I are very similar. We want to bridge the barriers when we want to demystify in different directions. And like the home birth setting and out of hospital experience across the country and what is being perceived around it. And I'm all about like demystifying midwifery private practices and what they can look like.
Yeah, which is amazing. And I think, you know, so much a part of where some of the innovation is happening, you know, in midwifery in general. And, you know, where I think a lot of people, you know, frankly, often just stumble upon, you know, by divine providence, a midwifery practice that then they're like, where was this, you know, for my last birth? Or, you know, I need to tell everyone, you know, in my life about this experience, because it's so different than, you know, some of the norms that people, you know, have been experiencing.
And that's the sad part is I would say, and that'd be another amazing study, is how are women finding home birth? Was it because their girlfriend had it? Was their mom had it? Did they have a friend that's a midwife? They just were exposed by XYZ, but I've seen it personally. 2/3 of them were because of a traumatic birth looking for other options. They got burned. They didn't ever want to do it this way again. So then they started doing the research of what else is out there. And so now you have these sweet little innocent first time moms that just are like, well, my friend had a home birth and I saw it on YouTube and it's fun and awesome idea. And then you have the beaten, battered women that had traumatic births that you have to help them through with. Yeah. So those were the two extremes of stereotypes I'd seen with how they found out about midwifery and our services and out of hospital setting.
Yeah. You know, that what you just described isn't unlike, you know, a lot of people finding our birth center when we were open and sort of how they, you know, came to that care. And I, you know, that I think that's part of why I'm interested in thinking through like this decision-making piece and the information that I feel like we need to help make more transparent for people, because, you know, I can't tell you how many people I would come to the birth center and just say, you know, I didn't know that, you know, when somebody, you know, when I said that I wanted to have like this kind of birth or, you know, this level of experience, that
it would be seeing yes. They'd have a birth plan. They'd tell them throughout pregnancy, you'll get it. And then during labor, it may be somebody else on call. There's so many variables they can't control. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that's not it's not to blame individual people. It's to blame our system
and the timing. You know? I mean, when you've got bigger variables, no, at all. It's just, yeah, sometimes it's harder because when you're in a more personalized setting, it's more realistic for you to build that relationship and be more likely to personalize what their wishes are versus you can't talk to the nurse that's on call. It's a different system and different setup that makes it harder to be more personalized.
Well, and even, you know, thinking about some of the bigger hospitals and, you know, the OB departments that are out there, I mean, they all exist on such a broad spectrum of intervention and also resources, like who has nitrous oxide, who has tubs, who has like certain things that we know, you know, people want and, you know, want to have access to. And, you know, what does that actually look like? You know, if a hospital says they offer water birth, does that mean anyone can have a water birth? Does that mean it depends on, you know, whether or not the one room that you can have a water
birth is available? And is that provider, is that your provider that uses that room?
You know, so, and obviously, you know, we have such a wide variety of settings. I think it would be hard to know exactly what's happening in every single setting, but I think, you know, when, you know, you, if you had that set of questions, if you, you know, if there are ways to help, you know, even just more transparently report cesarean rates. I mean, I think that's something that, you know, often is like the needle in the haystack, even trying to find out like, okay,
if their one colleague's 9% and they're 40%, I mean, that's just an instant. Why? I mean, that's just a simple number that makes people think, why are you more than this person?
but then also how is that going to affect you know, me. And not just, you know, it's about, you know, breastfeeding initiation rates. I mean, like, you know, there are so many things that we know speak volumes about the kind of
transparency care of care. And they had support to have it public on their website. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, I mean, I think that's all part of what, I think there are many groups that are working on these issues. And I think there's some, you know, even just today, Amy Romano, who's a, you know, midwife, based in Connecticut, but she, is the director of a group that she founded called Primary Maternity Care. And they just came out with a series of videos that are, you know, all these different, you know, interviews with different OBs and midwives about various aspects of, you know, creating your birth plan, thinking about your birth setting, thinking about your provider, and I haven't even had a chance to really look through them yet, but knowing Amy, they're fabulous.
Yeah, I'll have to find them.
You know, but I still think that, you know, part of what the, I think, again, the onus is on us as providers, but also within like the larger system, that, you know, making sure that data is more transparent and that we're holding people accountable to the data.
And not in a negative way, that we're trying to improve outcomes. I think that was a big shift in Europe, was when they were directly, like, even suturing, the culture is completely night and day difference in Europe than it is for us on the accountability of the follow-up care. And if the suturing is adequate and just the direct one-on-one management, but it took them 15 years of implementing a new program, a new standard, and having that mentality that it's not at all, you did something wrong. It's like, okay, this is the new data. This is the standards. Let me help you to better serve you. It's all how we approach it.
Yeah. I mean, I do. And I think that's, you know, I think that we also have some, you know, systemic issues that are slowly starting to be addressed. But I mean, you know, extending Medicaid coverage for the first year postpartum that's happening in a lot of states, you know, the fact that so many more people are working remotely, or, you know, that in Massachusetts, anyway, we've been under, I think it's been almost 2 years now, where people actually have, you know, state paid leave, for, you know, for, you know, kind of parental leave, when they have their babies. And, you know, that we've seen data from all of these different things showing that there are better breastfeeding rates, you know, better initiation into primary care, which is critical, especially if you've had complications during your pregnancy. And for so many people who were getting dropped from their healthcare coverage, like the minute they had their 6 week postpartum visit, I mean, you know, being able to actually have coverage at least through the first year of, you know, your, you know, the postpartum time, you know, I mean, all of these things that, you know, are also hopefully really moving the needle on some of these, you know, outcomes that we want to see improved. But yeah,
a lot more. Well, I'm excited, Erin. I can't wait for you to finish your PhD, and you and Lorraine and some of these amazing researchers are going to make massive things happen, just to have the data to present to politicians, to present to hospitals, that we need more of for midwives. So thank you so much for what you're doing.
Well, thanks for having me, Leslie. This is great.
Yeah, I appreciate it greatly. And if you're comfortable, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but may I put at the bottom of the YouTube just your email, so if people have questions or want to see if they can help you out with what you're working on?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.